Well, hello everyone. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. I'm Chuck Gregory. And we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so make sure you head over to freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Look for the donation button and show them some love. All right, I'm going to start off with a song as usual, and tonight this is a bit of an odd choice, and you'll know why a little bit later in the show. Oh come Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lonely exile here, until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. Okay, well, I hope I have your have you curious at this point, and you'll understand real soon. I am now going to introduce the first guest of tonight's program. I spoke earlier with Frank Cordero of the Des Moines Catholic Worker, and well, here's what we had to say.
Yo, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
Hi. Good to hear your voice. I know that, I understand that we're going to be able to speak a little longer than normal. And, and you did prep me, and, we're going to do a kind of a walkthrough, of the, what we call in the biblical world, the infant narratives. Which are actually the Christmas stories that we all know about.
Okay.
One of the things that helped me break down how to read the text, because it can be overwhelming. It's a giant book with lots of other stuff, 1200 years. It were the infant narratives and was the, step into functioning, you know, literary, analysis of the stories. The first thing we got to do is separate what we all know in the Christmas story. Got to be separating the infant born in a manger, the three kings and the star, and the angels singing. They're all mixed up in two stories, only two. There are only two Gospels that tell us anything about the birth of Jesus. Mark is the first Gospel, written during the war times at the peak of the destruction of the temple. And it starts with the story of Jesus Christ. And Jesus is a grown-up on the Jordan and getting baptized. That's how Mark starts his story. And the Gospel of John, on the other hand, it goes beyond birth. It doesn't speak much of the birth at all, if anything, but speaks its first 18 verses. The preamble talks about the preexistence of the Son of God, that the Word became flesh. So it takes us all the way back to the beginning of time. That's the Gospel of John. But the two other Gospels, Matthew and Luke, tell us the Christmas stories, and both of them are rich on their own merits. So part of the task is separating these two stories, and we're going to begin with the story of Matthew, his infant narrative. And Matthew is written from a clearly Jewish point of view. Whereas Luke, as we get into later, was written from a clearly a Greek and Roman pro-Jewish God-fearing, yet Roman point of view. It's really exciting to be able to see how both authors are trying to tell us something about the radical birth of this baby. Matthew begins his infant narratives, chapter 1, verse 1. It says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And then goes in, Abraham became the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Abraham, blah, blah, blah. This is a genealogy. It is common in the first century to have these sort of things for kings to verify their nobility. Mm-hmm. Matthew is a Jewish story because he has Jesus' genealogy going all the way back to Father Abraham.
Whoa.
So that's where that genealogy stopped. I just want us to think about Luke. This is helpful. Luke also has a genealogy. So, and this is the first text that the scripture scholars always use to try to introduce to the differences of these. Now, Luke has a genealogy about Jesus. Interesting enough, it isn't at the first of the book. It's more like in the third chapter. In fact, it's in the third chapter. Let me have a moment to find it. Yes. Well, it is. It's in the one of these chapters. I'll find it. But the birth of Jesus. Canical. All right. His birth of Jesus. The announcement of the birth of John. The announcement of the birth of Jesus. Oh, wow. I'm having a tough time finding his genealogy. Forgive Frank for his stumbleness. But the point of John, the Luke's version of genealogy, he starts off and says Jesus was created by God and goes all the way back to creation, Adam and Eve.
Wow.
So he has Jesus connected with Adam and Eve, names his as his parents. So they go all the way back through the Jewish history, all the way back through Abraham, and then all the way back through Moses and all the way back to Adam and Eve. So that's the Lukean genealogy. So then we get back to Matthew's story, which begins with, it just says, it's called the birth of Jesus. And this is how the birth of Jesus came about, when his mother Mary was betrothed to Joseph. But before they lived together, she was found to have child through the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, since he was a righteous man, yet unwilling to expose her of shame, decided to divorce her quietly. So here we are. It starts with Mary already pregnant, but she doesn't say anything in Matthew. Only person talking in Matthew and dealing here is Joseph. Happens through dreams. He has this unfortunate situation, and then he meets up with an angel who tells him, hey, it ain't what you think it is. Take her in, because the child's God's child, Emmanuel, the child with us. Behold, a virgin, and then the angel quotes an Old Testament saying from Isaiah, behold, the virgin shall be with child and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, God with us. So that happens. And then next scene, chapter 2, we're told about these visiting magi from the east. Now, magi in the first century are ambassadors and leaders in the great empires of Persia, the Babylonians. And magi travel through the Middle East and the Palestine area only to do business with Rome. And when the magi are gathered, such as they were gathered in this procession, they had gifts bearing for the next Caesar, Jesus. You see, when they speak of the Son of Man being born in the first century as the Son of God, they do not speak of it as a Trinitarian thing, but they speak of it as a very loaded political term, so that once Jesus was identified as the Son of God, he was in direct competition with Caesar. And in this story, the author is writing about these magi. Now, ask a Catholic, how many are there? How many wise men are there? They'll tell you three, only because the pictures always show three. There is nowhere in the text that says there's three. What we do have is these three great gifts they give. But before they give the gifts, the narrative is played out. They follow this star. Okay, we got astrology in this. Stars are big in the Middle East and in stories. And this is a moving star. Stars happen when kings and royalty are made and born. Stars are born. Well, this king had his own star. It was moving, had these wise men from the East. They weren't going to Rome. They went directly to Jerusalem. Hmm. When they got to Jerusalem, the text says, the whole city was in an uproar. Say what? The whole city in an uproar. Okay. King Herod had to come down, wake everybody up. What the hell's going on? Got the scribes. Everybody said, they're here for the king of the Jews. I'm the only king of the Jews I know of. Can someone help me? Scribes tell him, well, there is this prediction of a child being born in Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. He goes and tells the wise guys, hey, you know, this is great news. Give me a chance to catch up with you. Go to Bethlehem. Tell me. Report back. Now, this is what I love about the story. The star that didn't need no permission to come to Jerusalem from a guy named Herod, It moves from there to Bethlehem. Over the house where the babe is at. The wise men come with their gifts. They give their gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, all prefiguring things that are going to be important in Jesus' life. And then they're told in a dream, don't go back to Jerusalem. Herod's got no good for these kids. And then Joseph is told in a dream, get up, get out. The death squads are coming. Go to the superpower border of your day. Egypt. So they're refugees on the run. Right. Herod hears of this betrayal, sends his death squads to Bethlehem to kill the infants. 2 years or younger, as calculated by the star. The star gave away the location of the babe. It got the authorities on his case, and murder and killing pursued. This is an old story.
Yeah.
And he's in that space as an immigrant for 12 years, returns after King Herod the First is dead. Decides to go back to Nazareth instead of their hometown of Bethlehem. They got a better deal there. And that is how Matthew tells the story from a Jewish perspective. Yeah. All right. Stop there. Let's go to Luke. How Luke tells this story. All right.
Okay.
Frank's picture in his pages. Okay, so Luke starts his story. Interesting thing Luke does in his beginning of his story. This kind of Luke. Luke's opening, like the prologue. Since many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the events that have fulfilled among us, just as those who were eyewitness from the beginning and ministers to the word have handed them down to us, I too have decided, after investigating everything accurately anew, how do you investigate everything accurately anew, to write it down in an orderly sequence for you, most excellent Theophilus. Giveaway, Theophilus is a Greek name, so that you may realize the certainty of the teachings you have received. Hmm. All right. So clearly, this guy's writing to a well-off Greek who can read. People should know about reading and text in the first century. It was the tool of the one percenters.
Oh yeah.
Less than 10% of any population could even read. And if you read, you read to serve the one percenters. These writers, Jewish writers, all of them are Jewish or God-fearing, but they're all immersed out of the Jewish tradition. But it's not that simple. In the first century, they were also immersed in the Greek tradition. Hmm. This gospel is particularly written to a group of people called the God-fearers in the first century, who were Greeks, who were attracted to the Jewish tradition and joined the synagogue, didn't get circumcised, but they supported it. There were a lot of these people. This book is written to those folks who survived the destruction of the temple, and they're out there in their synagogues being scandalized. I mean, being associated with Christians at this time during the writings of these texts is like being associated with a subversive, underground, ugly, racially ugly group of people. Let's say in the Russias, they have a group of people in the southern parts that they're at war with, the Kardashians. Is that it? Or what's the name of that Caucasian? I can't remember. Every country's got its uglies. There's no doubt about it. And in the story of the Roman Empire, the Jewish people, this is during the Jewish-Roman Wars. Putting down the rebellions of the Jews in the middle of the empire was a great nuisance to the sprawling empire on the empire boundaries. And there was a lot of killing, a lot of going on. So it wasn't really cool to be associated with a Jew in the first century. It petered out pretty much when they had most of them dead. And then the Christians came back, Jews in another form. But the texts were already written. And this text is written to some Greeks to deal with the value systems of the Romans. The interesting way it starts after we get this brief introduction is, now we have, an announcement of a birth, but not of Jesus, but of John the Baptist. And the first place it starts is in the temple, where John the Baptist, his father, Zechariah, is serving, which was something that was common for poor. It was a poor people's brigade who got to go into the large temple and clean it. They were the cleaners, but they had to be ordained and really low-level kind of bottom feeders, and this is what they let the country bumpkins do. And this is where Zechariah and Elizabeth, Zechariah was with his crowd, his hometown, like the I think of the National Guard going and doing federal work in Washington. They drew sticks, and he got to go into the holies of holies by himself and clean the two or three vessels. I mean, whatever. But he went in there, and an angel confronted him and said, "Hey, got good news for you. Your wife's going to have a baby." And he said, "How can this be? She's old." And then the angel said, "Too late." Struck him dumb as it couldn't speak. He went out of the temple gaze. People were all to say, "What happened?" He wrote down. And they sent him home, and it was a real weird experience. And then the next thing we hear about is there's another announcement. Let me look. There's two announcements. So there's one announcement for John the Baptist, and then they go to the second announcement of the birth of Jesus. And the second announcement has Mary with Joseph I think it's in Bethlehem, and an angel visits her and says to her, you're going to have a baby. And Mary says, well, how can this be? I've never seen a man. Now, interestingly, Mary can ask the question and doesn't get struck dumb. Zechariah, the guy in the temple, just asked the question. The angel went, hey, that's not good enough. You're not working. Went right to her. And then the angel says, trust God. And she says, have it happen to me. You know, let it be as it's meant to be. And then we have this announcement of Jesus's birth. Now, then, after that happens, Mary goes to visit Elizabeth. Now, this is a very poignant and beautiful story of two pregnant women. If we were to call these stories, if we see them in our own light, we call them problem pregnancies. Because they were very much problem pregnancies in the first century. You begin with Elizabeth, who's now having a baby, and she's like someone being 65 having a baby. You know? I mean, like, okay. The whole damn town will know, hey, you know, old man John's wife, Elizabeth, she's pregnant. No. She's 65. Nobody can have a baby at 65. I mean, it's like a problem pregnancy. The other problem pregnancy is Mary, a maiden, pregnant, and the marriage scene is not kosher. Who knows who the father is? Very public, very shameful place to be. Yet, despite those realities, these two women know that they're beyond those kind of barriers, and they're doing God's bidding, and they meet, and it's such a joyous meeting, really poignant, because before a word is spoken, the baby John the Baptist, who's got to jump on Jesus like, I don't know, 3 months, is kicking, the baby kicked, you know, and they both embrace each other. It's a wonderful scene. After that scene is done, Mary sings the canticle. There's an extraordinary prayer here that Mary sings before she goes back, to Bethlehem. And then we have the story of, the birth of John the Baptist. And then Ezekiel finds his voice again, sings his own canticle. And then we have, the birth of Jesus, a lot about Mary, lots of things going on. It's much a fuller story. We hear about the shepherds, coming and they're singing, in the barnyards, out in the fields, the greatest Christmas concert ever. No one recorded it. And then they have a story of they continue the story with the circumcision of Jesus, all of these things transpiring not through Joseph's eyes and voice, as it was in Matthew, but through Mary's eyes and heart. Amazing statements, and the truth comes through the heart of people. People are changed by a revolutionary love through the heart. It's really great personal feminine stuff going on. They got Jesus circumcised. Then they got 12 years later, they present him to the temple. There's all that confusion in the temple when he sets the priest straight about all this stuff that they had no idea a kid like him would know. Just to be a prefigure about, who he's to be. Yeah. And then he's disciplined to go back to, with his parents at 12 and grow and become an adult, cause the world will need him. And that sets up the story.
Yeah.
So these are two very different stories. One, like Luke, is told where there is no political involvement. It's all secret. Nobody knows about it. Nobody cares about
right.
it.
It's
all about being able to recognize him in an affluent culture of temple worship. He gets born despite the odds. Same thing in Matthew, only that it's a political thing.
Yeah.
The star brings to Jerusalem and all of the soldiers and the killing. So it's a totally different story, yet both of them point to the same adult story.
Right.
About what Jesus is all about.
Well, that's really, thank you, Frank, for sharing that, analysis. And, it really, you brought out a lot of the contrast between the stories, and yet they're still describing the same thing, which.
Yeah, I'm sorry I lost the genealogy. I'm going to kick myself in the butt. Catholics are so bad at doing this stuff. Yeah,
we're going to have to stop now. But I really appreciate
thank you.
You're taking the time to go over this. It's pretty amazing stuff. Thank you, Frank.
I love it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye bye. All right, our next guest of the evening is Philip Ferrugio. Phil joins me each week for this second segment, and we lead off his section with his latest column, which he reads, and then we'll be talking about it. So I'm just about to bring him in. Here we go. And so this section of the show is titled Fire Stupid.
Oh, Chuck.
Well, hello, Philip.
Hello,
you are
on
the
air, Chuck.
You are on the air.
Well, let's get right to it, Chuck, okay? You know, Three Ring Circus. You remember when we were all kids and the circus came to town, inside the big tent or the arena? We would sit and view all the many goings-on from the three rings in front of us. It was highly entertaining, especially for childish minds. Folks, the circus has always been with us inside of this American empire. The three rings, for many generations, have always been the same. The two rings play side by side, are the two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, along with each their mainstream media minions. The interesting one is the third ring, placed in back of these two. That is, of course, our deep state, the one that controls and orchestrates how the other two rings will function and operate. Perhaps the only visibility of this third ring is the countless foundations and think tanks it created and uses to represent it. Now, this deep state is not to be confused with what the Trump conspiracy thumpers claim it is, because you see, Trump and his cabal get their marching orders from the deep state. No, the real deep state, what Eisenhower aptly labeled as the military-industrial complex, of course, he waited cowardly until his final year in office to name it. It controls both parties and, of course, the mainstream media, even some parts of the alternative media. Now, think about it for a moment. On the key issues affecting the future of our nation, with some exceptions, the three rings of this circus see eye to eye. They all celebrate our excessive militarism and vote for every increase in the military spending. So much so that under the Bush-Cheney cabal, it reached 50% of our federal taxes. Yet, under Obama in 2011, it actually trumped that figure, no pun intended. Now, these three rings support the 1,000-plus military bases overseas, now in over 100 different countries. They gave a president the right to step above the constitutional guarantees we should uphold and cherish. The two-party political media rings suck up to the bankers and Wall Street predators who are part of ring number three. Imagine that Democrat Chuck Schumer, a senator who has been a key part of the Senate Banking Committee for probably decades, has done squat in regard to the usurious credit card interest rates. These are charges that millions of us who cannot pay our bills in full each month are hit with. With the prime rate at around 4.75, those sharks charge many of us rates of well over 20%, sometimes as high as 28%. Now, as far as health coverage and insurance, we know the Republican ring wants to have the private insurers assume total control, even of Medicare. Meanwhile, the Democratic ring, puppets also to the deep state, cannot even push for a Medicare for all without keeping those private insurance privateers in force. There's only one current presidential candidate running this year who wants the private insurers out, and that's Bernie Sanders. Tulsi Gabbard is not really totally clear on that position yet. Remember that Obama, as candidate in 2008, received over $21 million in donations from the healthcare industry, while John McCain got a little over $7 million. Do you really think that Obama was going to go all out for Medicare with all without private insurers? So all three rings in this empire circus want to restart a Cold War with both the Russians and the Chinese, especially the Russians. As far as the Chinese, well, they are so ingrained within our economy with both their millions of products sold here, see how many are not made in China in Walmart, and of course, the trillions of dollars in bonds and stocks that they hold, along with the real estate they now invest in here. We have to tread cautiously. So it has to be the Russians that the deep state is targeting through their dummy straw man of NATO. Look at the Ukraine, who both political parties have held up as a, quote, free nation, unquote, being threatened by Russian aggression. Well, not only did the deep state, through the neocons like Victoria Nuland working for Hillary Clinton, with help from neocon Vice President Biden and the ever-present neocon John Bolton, they orchestrated what many consider a coup a few years ago. Just look at who is in power in that nation now. The Svoboda Party, a self-proclaimed ultra-nationalist party filled with neo-Nazis who still honor the German invasion of the Ukraine in World War II. These are the victims of Russian aggression. Of course, the real story behind all this is the deep state's International Monetary Fund's influence in the dismantling of the Ukraine economy. This has been done to suit with the many international predatory corporate interests that are over there. As was done throughout much of Europe, folks, and of course most of South and Central America, privatization of resources and government-run nonprofit services has always been their goal. Now, more and more, we see this same plan being carried out right here at home, folks. So, in conclusion, since every circus needs an abundance of clowns, we have a slew of them in America 2019. Tune in to BoobTube's mainstream news and news talk shows and view these journalist clowns like Fox's Hannity, CNN's Cuomo, and MSNBC's Maddow. Then go to C-SPAN's coverage of the Congress and get a whiff of those clowns pretending to be statesmen and stateswomen. As the bumper sticker so beautifully stated, elect a clown and get a circus. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you, I think if you had one of those cars that they used to have riding around at the circus, you remember those clown cars?
You
could probably fit just about all of the Congress into one of those.
Yeah, it's really a shame. And what's interesting, tonight as we're sitting here, the United Kingdom's parliamentary election results, and it looks like the Conservatives are going to really make up, not only regain control, but they're going to have more control. And, in England they have a few more, they have a multi-party system, but basically it's still a two-party system, you know. And like the Democrats and Republicans here, And so you ask yourself, why would so many working class, middle class people in the UK, why would they continually vote for the Conservatives who do not represent them? And I guess you have to, well, it's, of course, it's about the Brexit controversy, whereas Labour was kind of, you know, diddling and dabbling and maybe saying that they should stay, and the Tories wanted to get out right away, and a lot of the public voted to get out, so that could be part of the, but I think it's more than that, Chuck. I think it's like what's happening here, is that the Democrats or the Labour in England, they just don't really have bold ideas to help the average person. And I think the public sometimes gets aware of that, that it's really just a dog and pony show, you know, snake oil.
Yeah.
So something to think about, Chuck.
Well, I really wouldn't be surprised if it's an indicator of how things will go here.
Well, yeah, I think the impeachment, which I was totally against, as much as I have no love for Donald Trump and his party, mm-hmm. and I'm a socialist, and believe me, everything that the Republicans stand for is against what I stand for. But to have the Democrats go this route, and the fact that Biden and his son are at the center of this whole controversy. It's going to come back to haunt the Democrats, because it's making Trump into a sympathetic figure. If you study the whole history, the recent history of the Ukrainian situation, Chuck, and you see, first of all, how much money that Joe Biden was making after he got out of office as vice president, and a lot of it came from dealings with the Ukraine. Sounds like the Yukon, if I'm not sure.
Right.
Where the hell is Sergeant Preston now that we need him? But anyway, and I think that's all going to be cut. I mean, the Republicans are going to trumpet that. I mean, seriously, you know that. They're going to be blasting that in the spring and summer. And it's going to come back to hurt the Democrats. So I think the whole procedure was really very foolish. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think it's a dumb plan too, but I don't know. I guess we'll see how it goes.
I mean,
but it seems to me that the Democrats right now are too busy fighting each other and doing the anything but Trump thing. To really look at making changes, having a platform, having some real plans to make changes. They're attack instead of build.
Well, I think when Obama ran, he really conned a lot of people, because with this hope and change. And the point I made in the piece was, I mean, the guy was getting three times as much money from the healthcare industry. I knew when I heard that, even right after the election, I knew that he wasn't going to do anything about trying to introduce real, Medicare for all.
Yeah.
I mean, because he already sold out on that. And if you remember, his biggest promise was, first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to close Guantanamo, which he never did.
Yeah, right.
He increased the number of drone attacks by 10 times under his presidency. There were more assassinations overseas. I mean, if you look at the foreign policy, he did exactly what the war industry and what the war hawks wanted, in within the government. Yeah. So he didn't do anything. As far as on the domestic, what did he do? I mean, he didn't do anything, because they can't do anything. The Democrats cannot do anything because they're owned basically by the same interests that own the Republican Party.
Yeah.
They represent. And I'll tell you what's funny It shows you how crazy everything is in this whole world. The lady for BBC, I was watching the BBC American News, the lady in England who was the political editor for the BBC, she makes a statement on why this all happened, that the Tories, the Conservatives, are going to be even stronger. And she goes, well, you see, what it was that Labor made the move of going way, way, way too far to the left. And a lot of people didn't like that. And that's, and I'm sitting there saying, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
It's hogwash. Yeah. Jeremy Corbyn is a socialist, but his party would not even let him, really be bold on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it just shows you the power of the media telling people that's, that, and now they're doing that over here. They are villainizing. Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
His own party, Chuck.
Right.
His
just like last time.
Party.
Just
yeah,
like last time.
They don't want him as a candidate.
Exactly.
They don't want him as a candidate.
Yep.
Because he has, and believe me, he's not even far enough left for me, because I'm a true socialist and he's not. He's a hybrid. He's a capitalist socialist. But the point is they are labeling him as, oh, he's extreme, he's radical, because you want to have Medicare without the private insurance companies being involved. That's radical. Mm. Why he's questioning why we're all over the world and all these bases, he's not really making a big point of that.
Radical,
And he's making, and about, as far as Wall Street, he wants to put a tax I think it was Ralph Nader had the idea. do a transaction tax every time pennies for every share, but it adds up with the institutional investors when they're buying 10,000 shares at a time. So it's not for the small investor. It's going to cost him, pocket change for a transaction. But that's radical. Everything Sanders says that to me is very moderate. To them, it's radical. So they don't want him.
Yeah.
And they're doing whatever they can. That's why they ran like 20-something people this year. They want to marginalize Sanders. Well, and look what's happening. I'll tell you what's happening, Chuck. Somebody told me about it. It wasn't even covered in the major news. In Brooklyn, about 10 days ago, there was a rally for Sanders. There was like 45,000 people. It was a mass amount of people showed up for a rally for him.
Huh.
And of course, the media didn't cover it. Didn't cover it. Locally in New York, it was covered.
Yeah,
but the national media, they didn't cover it. And meanwhile, the schmuck, Mayor Pete, he's in Iowa with spending a lot of money. He has a lot of money behind him now. He has a lot of these corporate donors, and he's got people on the ground. And so he'll speak to like 80 people or 100 people, and they make a big deal about it, a big crowd. Yeah. So do you remember when Howard Dean ran in 2004?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember him. Yep.
You remember in Iowa when they're going to have the Iowa caucuses?
Right.
You remember that night when he gave a speech to his own crowd, in his own campaign, headquarters? Remember he gave that speech and it was covered on the media? And you remember he started like raising his voice and going into a frenzy? And that night, the following day, the media labeled him as like off the wall, crazy, fucking demagoguery.
Huh.
And if you remember, that took him right out of the race. I don't know if you remember that. It took him right out. It took him right out of the race. It did. It took him right out of the race. It knocked him right out. After that one night when he made that speech at a rally, and I saw it. I saw it live.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I said, "Well, what's the big deal? He's talking to his own followers, and he's getting them all. He's getting them all. Energized." And they said, "Oh, he's like a madman. He lost it, and he was very demagoguic, whatever that word is." So that's what they can do.
Exactly.
And if you remember,
and that's what they do every time you know, these days. Now, you know, there was a time when people with ideas, you know, and something that wasn't just the same as everybody else could actually get out there and run and have a chance.
Yeah, well, as long as they allow, you know, money into politics, I remember Senator Paul Simon from Illinois, maybe 20-something years ago, 25 years ago, he made a statement. He said the following. He said, you know, when I go out on the campaign trail and I'm staying in a hotel and I'm out all day, when I come back to my hotel room, there's a bunch of messages for me. And I go through, you know, all the messages, and he says, I'm going to be totally blunt. He says, the first call I make is to the biggest donor. He said, that is unfortunately the way it is.
Yeah.
Okay, and he was being honest. He was being very honest. He said, but that is the way it is, because we need money to run these campaigns.
Right.
You know, so anyway, I mean, the point is, as long as you have money in politics, You are never. It's going to be a fixed deck. I mean, look at Donald Trump. If he didn't have all that money behind him, he would have never been able to, you know, to get the all the notoriety he got early on, you know. So I'm just saying, it's sad that the two party system here and even in England, even though there's other parties, but that the two main parties here and in England are both controlled ultimately by the super rich who control the corporate interests, including the banking and the war economy, whatever the war economy is. And that's the way it is. And they control the media, and the media, mainstream media, they'll call themselves Republican or Democrat and liberal. It's all bull crap. Okay. Basically, they will never, ever, I mean, when did you ever see on any, I'm going to ask you, Chuck, when did you see on any of the mainstream media news talk shows the issue of public funding of elections? When did you ever see anyone on who's an expert on it or an advocate for it?
Actually,
can you remember ever seeing?
I think that particular issue actually gets covered fairly often, Bill.
Not on public funding. I have never, ever seen, and I watch a lot of shows, they will never have an advocate for public funding of elections, of no private money in elections. They will never have that. They don't want the public to even be aware of the possibility. You know what I'm saying? So it's really sad because it is a fixed deck. And we do live in a circus. This is a circus. And we're being amused.
Yeah.
The impeachment hearings are amusing.
I'm not that amused.
Well, I mean, the political campaigns are very amusing.
I know what you mean.
I mean,
you're right.
Yeah.
It's all a big show. And
and the debates.
Full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, blah, blah, blah.
Well, because they won't talk. I mean, look at Elizabeth Warren. I mean, she shot herself in the foot because... You know, now it comes out that she was a lawyer representing, you know, corporate interests, right? Mm-hmm. When she was an attorney, her son did not go to public school. Her son went to private school, okay? And she's a multimillionaire, which she never talks about. You know, she comes across like a school mom.
Well, you know. I mean,
I'm just making a point.
I don't think any of those things surprise me or really make me. Any less willing to consider her?
Well, I have to say that, in my opinion, as your friend, you're in the minority. Because there's a lot of people who have gotten turned off when they hear this information. Hmm. Like with Harris, when it came out, what she was doing to the to the offenders, you know, with the jail terms and everything.
Yeah,
and I mean that just hurt her beyond compare, and she could not recover from that, and she's out of the race. I'm just telling you that, you know, if you're going to be in the public eye, you have to be careful because they have ways of seeking out all of these little informations. Not only that right. she said she was American Indian when she went to Harvard, but the other things. When, you know, she's for the people, yet she was representing these corporate interests, you know, trying to defend them. I mean, it's a sad situation. That's all I'm saying, you know. I mean, give the Republicans credit for give the devil credit for he lets you know that he is the devil. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
He lets you know I'm the devil. I'm going to eat you alive.
Yeah.
No,
right.
But seriously, it's a sad situation. That's all.
It is
sad.
It is. Well, Philip, thank you very much for joining me once again. I appreciate having you on every week. And talk to you soon.
It's the Empire Stupid. Take care.
Okay. It's theempirestupid.com. You'll find lots of columns and recordings of Philip's interview show, which is really interesting. There should be a new one coming out very soon. Thank you, everyone. And I will talk to you on the other side of the station break, which should be coming up just any second now. I'd like to just take this one brief chance to say thank you for being here. Hope you'll be back next week and every week right here at Revolution Radio at freedomslip.com or newdream.us. All right, talk to you soon. Welcome back, everyone. I'm pleased to be back, and I'm now going to introduce Richard Flamer. Richard runs the Catholic Worker Farm in Chiapas, Mexico, and I'm going to play my conversation with him just 2 or 3 hours ago.
This is the feast day of the Virgin of Guadalupe, and all over Mexico, there are pilgrims walking, riding bicycles, motorcycles, cars, many collecting in the Basilica of Guadalupe in Mexico City. It's estimated that between 10 and 11 million pilgrims have arrived at the Basilica.
Wow.
Yeah. And even here in San Cristobal, we get, I went into town this morning, and it normally takes me half an hour to drive in. Today, it took me almost an hour because of all the pilgrims walking with torches, followed by vehicles, and of course the progress was slow, but pretty interesting. I even passed one group of motorcyclists who I had to stop at the because of all the traffic, and I counted 64 motorcyclists sitting on the lawn in front of a little column which denoted the death of 4 motorcyclists some 10 years back. And they all came to pay homage to the 4 downed cyclists. Pretty impressive. But at any rate, that was the earlier part of the day. I wanted to talk about the caravan of the Mothers of the Disappeared. Every year for the last 13 years, a group of mostly women have traveled 2,500 miles across Mexico searching for their children who went missing while traveling through the country from Central America. The caravan brings together mothers from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. They then travel together across Mexico in search of their loved ones. In the 13 years since the caravan was first organized, 270 missing migrants have been located. Part of the purpose of the caravan is to denounce and highlight the issue of migrants disappearing while in transit through Mexico. Of the 270 migrants discovered, over 90% are men. Women are much harder to find, especially if they've been forced into the sex trade. The women from the caravan enter a town the first day. This trip was Tapachula, a border town on the Mexican side where they placed photographs, visited brothels, bars, and community centers. They have forged links with organizations, some government agencies. They were met in Tapachula by representatives from small human rights groups, from the federal agency, and also some of those local human rights groups and a group from Mesoamerican migrant movement. While in Tapachula, the women of the caravan had some clues relating to 10 of the disappeared who were rumored to be in one of the three prisons in the region. The clues were developed when they exhibited photos in the central square of the city. They subsequently, with a group of federal officials, visited all three prisons without success. The mothers moved to Huixla in Chiapas after 4 days in and around Tapachula, where they visited for 3 days, Huixla. Huixla on the coast has long been a center for destination for migrants. Hmm. The women roamed the bars, community centers, and talked with whomever would listen. Two of the women spoke with several Central Americans who had been in Mexico for years without contact from their relatives. The Central Americans asked the women of the caravan to help contact their relatives on their return to their countries. From Huixla, the caravan left for Comitán, where they proceeded with a march to the center of the city, where was held a Mayan cleansing ceremony and an exhibition of photographs of their sons and daughters. When the caravan arrived in San Cristóbal de las Casas, they marched from the Zócalo to the Human Rights Center, where they held a press conference. They were joined by half a dozen local indigenous mothers whose children had also disappeared. The numbers are hard to come by because of the transient population of the poor, but it was estimated by the staff of the Fray Bartolomé de las Casas Human Rights Center here in San Cristóbal that at least 70,000 Central Americans have disappeared on their way north while transiting Mexico. With the hundreds of cadavers unearthed in the deserts of northern Mexico, Coahuila, Sonora, Chihuahua, and Tamaulipas, the state morgues are overwhelmed. In some areas, as many as 60 to 80 corpses are in refrigerated containers, while the doctors who do the autopsies are performing 6 to 8 each day. DNA samples are extracted and recorded, which the mothers of this period check constantly against their own samples. The mothers check at each state morgue that they pass through along the way. From Veracruz, the women went to Atitlacahua, Hidalgo, where they were received by Father David Corcharo of the San Miguel Archangel Church, who along with his parish had prepared a meal. The following day in Tezcuiz, Curapan, Querétaro, there was discovered a woman discovered that her son was in the town. They eventually hooked up. The woman hadn't seen her son for 14 years. Some of the women split off to check the town for other women, for other children. The caravan in the last few weeks has been traveling to the north of Mexico with stops in San Luis Potosí, Monterrey, and Chihuahua, sometimes with a police escort. Most often not. They ran into big problems in Jalisco where the drug lords threatened the group. They were forced to turn back to Monterrey where they continued their search. I came across the poem through a friend of mine. It's called Home by Warsan Shear, a British writer, poet, and teacher. He was born in Kenya of Somali parents. She currently lives in Los Angeles. No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. Your neighbor's running faster than you, breath bloody in their throats. The boy you went to school with who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay. No one leaves home unless home chases you, fire under feet, hot blood in your belly. It's not something you ever thought of doing until the blade burnt thrusts into your neck. And even then, you carried the anthem under your breath. Only tearing up your passport in an airline toilet, sobbing as each mouthful of paper made it clear that you wouldn't be going back. You have to understand that no one puts their children in a boat unless the water is safer than the land. No one burns their palms under trains, beneath carriages. No one spends days and nights in the stomach of a truck beating on a newspaper unless the miles traveled mean something more than journey. No one crawls under fences. No one wants to be beaten, pitied. No one chooses refugee camps or strip searches where your body is left aching, or prison, because prison is safer in a city of fire. And one prison guard in the night is better than a truckload of men who, like your father, no one could take it. No one could stomach it. No one's skin would be tough enough. Go home. The go home blacks, refugees, dirty immigrants, asylum seekers sucking our country dry, niggers with their hands out. They smell strange, savage, messed up in their country, and now they want to mess ours up. How do the words, the dirty looks roll off your backs? Maybe because the blow is softer than a limb torn off. Or the words are more tender than 14 men between your legs. Or the insults are easier to swallow than rubble, than bone. And your child's body in pieces. I want to go home, but home is the mouth of a shark. Home is the barrel of the gun. And no one would leave home unless home chased you to the shore. Unless home told you to quicken your legs. Leave your clothes behind. Crawl through the desert. Wade through the oceans. Drown. Save the hunger. Beg. Forget pride. Your survival is more important. No one leaves home until home is a sweaty voice in your ear saying, leave. Run away from me now. I don't know what I've become, but I know that anywhere is safer than here. Pretty moving for me, especially from with the women and men that I've run into who are fleeing Honduras or El Salvador. And so we come on the season of Advent, and which for me is always a season of hope. I don't think much of Christmas per se, but I do think of Advent. I think of the joys that we can share in the coming of the new Lord. And I guess that's all I have to say tonight.
Well, that was just so moving, Richard. That's really something. I have some questions.
Sure.
With the I have questions on every part. All right. The feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe, or the Virgin of Guadalupe. This seems to be something that it's distinctly Mexican, but it's been adopted all over the world. There's a huge gathering apparently in Chicago, in Los Angeles, other parts of the United States, and I'm pretty sure I came across some places, you know, in other parts of the world, you know. Can you tell us a little about the history of that?
Well, it's on this date, 480 years ago, a simple peasant from Juan Diego was strolling up the hill and saw a vision of the Virgin of Guadalupe. He left. It frightened him. He went back to town, talked to the local priest, who said, no, you must be making it up. And the Virgin, as he was leaving, said to him, this is me. This is the Virgin of Guadalupe. He went back to town, talked to the priests, and ended up heading up the same road the following day, and gathered roses along the way, which he gave to the Virgin when he saw her again. She gave him her cloak to prove to the priests that she was, in fact, the Virgin. That image, and he took both the roses and the cloak back to his village. And that cloak is the one that's on display at the Basilica of Guadalupe. Wow. And the images that you see from the Hispanic world, are those images are all taken from that cloak. That is the face, the dress, the whole manner is taken from that. And where they celebrate the Mass for the Virgin of Guadalupe, they always have at noon a Mass where they pass out roses that are collected in memory. And I can't tell you how important it is, first of all, that she was seen by the poorest of the poor,
yeah.
A worker. And that she appears not as an Anglo woman, but as an indigenous face, as an indigenous woman. For the indigenous people of Latin America, it's just a tremendous symbol, worthy of everything they know about religion comes from that. So that when you see, I mean, it's like, for me, it's like it's an important symbol, but it's sort of like one of the problem. One of the problems I have back up in the States is this image of Christ as this blonde-haired white guy with blue eyes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, and here the image is so different. It's a spirituality that exists not just on the Day of the Virgin, but all through these people's lives. When someone's having a bad experience and their daughter or son's in the hospital, and they pray not to God, they pray to the Virgin Mary for relief. And those who have had miracles in their life for the year all head out for these pilgrimage. So that they, on television today, tonight, they had interviews with people, and one fellow had, was on his knees, on his hands and knees, walking to the basilica. And he had proceeded that way for almost 20 miles.
Wow.
In thanks to the Virgin of Guadalupe for saving his daughter, who had been kidnapped and they found her. Those kinds of images are all over. And not just in Mexico, but also in Latin America as a whole. And even there was Pope Francis over the last 3 days has in his daily masses at St. Peter's has commented and worked with Mexicans who went there for celebrations, some dance groups, and it's a very lively affair with rockets and a big fiesta and fireworks all the time.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's great for everybody except my dogs. My dogs are going crazy with the noise.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure.
Yeah. But aside from that, it's a really joyous occasion. I, for one, am glad to be a part of it. I went to Mass instead this morning at 7:30. Huh? And the priest was just outstanding. And the Mass that I go to usually is at a church in San Cristobal that has, it's where most of the nuns and retired priests go. They're the same one. Normally there's only about 30, 40 people in the Mass, but today it was 300.
Wow. Okay.
So, huh. Pretty impressive.
Indeed. Indeed.
But we don't want to forget about the mothers that have disappeared.
Yes. And, so this caravan, is that, is it, I mean, is this specific day especially significant for the caravan, or is that something that is going on for a much longer time?
No, they generally come and spend a month, usually the month of December.
Okay.
And they, because when they travel, they have to stay in various towns for like 3 or 4 days to get the word out and to talk to people and check on clues and that sort of thing. And they almost always spend a day at the morgue in the state, in each of the different states.
Yeah.
Checking DNA samples and so forth.
Right.
But they're, each year it's a different group of mothers. It's expensive for them to come up. And so in their villages back in Salvador or Honduras, other mothers of the disappeared, other friends and neighbors gather the money for them to come and be part of the caravan. Yeah. So it's not like they can come every year.
Right.
So they continue, so far as I've been able to find out from news accounts, they've managed to find three people this trip.
Okay.
And part of it also, they try to publicize the fact that so many have disappeared.
Yeah. Did you say it's 70,000 that are missing?
Yes. 70,000. The estimate is 70,000 have disappeared.
That's horrible.
Yeah. Yep.
Well,
sorry I can't be more elegiac or elegiac.
Yeah,
but you know, this is the time to be thinking of things like that. And it's okay. I'm spending much more time these days in prayer and in heading to Mass.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out why it is we're that we take on the suffering of the world, and I understand that that was sort of the mission of Jesus.
So yeah.
We try to be like Christ.
Wow. Richard, thank you.
I probably went past my 15 minutes. This is good.
I had a little extra time available, and so I'm glad that we got to talk a little bit more. I really appreciate having you on the show each month, and, thank you.
Okay. Take care, Chuck. I'll talk to you next month.
Talk to you next year.
Okay. See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, once again, thanks to Richard Plamer from Chiapas, Mexico. And thanks to you, our listeners. And stay tuned. Next, we'll hear from Thomas Wertmann to close out the show. Thomas will tell us some interesting things about UFOs. Wait for it. Talk to you soon. Welcome back, everyone, to the New American Dream Radio Show. And once again, we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Our final guest of the evening is going to be Thomas Wertmann. And Thomas joins me each month from Ohio. And he's the head of MUFON in Ohio. That's something UFO something. And
hello?
He should be. Well, hello, Thomas. I was just trying to remember what MUFON stood for when I was introducing
hey,
you.
Hello.
And
you're breaking up?
I totally forgot. So why don't you tell us?
You're breaking up. Hello?
You sound good to me. Are you able to
hello?
Hear me? All right, I'm going to call you. I'm going to hang
hello,
up and call you back.
Up. I'm not getting anything.
Well, folks, once in a while this happens, and so we're just going to try again. And usually this will fix it. So let's all cross our fingers and hope that we don't have any aliens getting in the way there. Okay, here we go.
Hello, let's
hello,
try it
Thomas.
Again.
I hope you can hear me better this time.
I can hear you better this time. You know, in the UFO field, we think this is outside interference, you know?
Yeah, sure it is.
Well, at least let's blame it on that tonight.
Okay. So I was trying to introduce you. I was trying to remember what MUFON stood for, and I didn't remember. So before you get into your column, why don't you remind us of that? Thanks.
Okay. MUFON is the Mutual UFO Network. We're the largest UFO investigation group in the world. And we've got investigators not only like in the U.S., but we've got investigators worldwide. And I couldn't tell you the exact number, but we're probably looking maybe 800 investigators worldwide right now. And with the group, if somebody out there in your audience happens to have a UFO report, something they've seen that they can't explain, they can go to our website at MUFON, that's MUFON.com. And what they can do is they can submit a report online. And rather than just kind of like going into like file 13 and disappearing forever, the report, what the report does is it gets assigned back to investigators in the region. If we have some from that region, again, this is a very big organization. And when you think about all the countries we're in, sometimes it's difficult to find investigators. But we try the best we can to find investigators as close to the sighting area as possible. And what they'll do is they'll research it and do follow-up with the witnesses and work the report to see if we can find an explanation or maybe no explanation for what somebody's seen. And right now, like where I'm at in Ohio, I think this year we've gotten 200 and some cases in alone, just in our state. And if you think about a worldwide situation, how many cases an organization like we can be getting a year. And it's an incredible number. And I'm really interested in the work that we do because I love to look at the reports, look at the data behind it, and, you know, see if I can maybe go after and find this big answer we're all looking for. What's creating these? Is it maybe military? Is it maybe somebody just misidentifying something? I still get reports of people finding Venus and thinking it's something unusual. But on the other hand, you get these cases that come in that you just leave your head, you know, you're scratching your head that you have no explanation for. And those are ones I really love to dig into. So that's a little bit about MUFON, Chuck, if that's what you're going after.
Well, yes. And thank you. Thank you for that. Because especially for our newer listeners, it's great to have a good idea of, you know, what you do. So thanks.
Yeah.
Proceed.
Oh,
now.
No problem. Okay, let's rock. You know, this one story I cannot get away from. And we've talked about on some different episodes, and that's the naval sightings that occurred back in 2004 and 2015. These occurred by pilots from the Nimitz and also pilots from the Teddy Roosevelt. And what happened is they were out doing training exercises when they had encounters. And these encounters, for your newer listeners, and just kind of bring them up to speed a little bit, these encounters, the Navy eventually came out and said, hey, these pilot videos, which kind of got released in a roundabout way. There are some that say they came out through proper channels. Other ones said, well, no, they didn't. They weren't really supposed to hit the public eye. They were for internal use only. Well, these videos that came out called Go Fast, Gimbal and Non-Gimbal, were put on a website called To the Stars Academy. And the guy whose group put them out is actually a former rock singer for a group called Blink 182 that's very passionate about this subject. Well, the videos came out. The Navy admitted that these are true videos from aircraft, and they don't have an explanation behind it. Well, the two encounters, the one in 2004 is off the coast of California. The one in 2015, you're looking at being off of the coast of like Virginia, going down through like North Carolina, the Florida region. Well, when I looked at these myself when the reports came in, I'm like, wow, we're getting sightings off of the coast by naval pilots. And these pilots are flying F-18s, which were the state-of-the-art aircraft at both times. Both aircraft also had some of the newest radar systems available. Not only did you have aircraft sighting them, but they're being picked up by naval ships also. So you've got multiple locations picking them up. In the case of the Nimitz off of the coast of California, it was a guided missile cruiser called the Princeton that was tracking them on the most high-tech state-of-the-art system we've got as far as radar goes. The great thing about these stories is pilots from the group out in the Nimitz, we've had some pilots come forward and tell their story in public. You've also had other crew members on board the ship who have come out and become vocal about their experiences. The same is true with the Teddy Roosevelt. So now we're getting military personnel coming out and talking about these encounters. But when I go back and review the cases, there's some things that kind of really bug me. And one thing I look at is, with these stories, both of these incidents happen to occur in military operation areas, where what they were doing is shakedown training exercises before they were deployed to regions like the Gulf. Another thing that happened, the objects were viewed between like 80,000 feet and sea level. Well, one thing I noticed on charts for pilots, they warn pilots that there's a military operation area coincidentally between 80,000 feet and sea level, the same altitudes. These objects moving at super high speeds. They're also moving at slow speeds. They made drastic turns, and there are times that they traveled across the sky like they had no care in the world. Pilots reported also seeing water churned up below where the objects were at. And something that was interesting during the intercept with the Nimitz, the pilot was in an engagement, the object left, and the pilot was told to go to a ready area called a cap point, which is a combat air patrol point. This point, by the way, Chuck, is only known to like the pilot and essential crew members on board the ship. It's not widely known where he was supposed to go to. Well, in the case of the Nimitz, when the pilot was told to go to this cap point, or I should say pilots, they started heading to the cap point. And this object, which was departed, the next thing you know, crew members on board the Princeton radioed the planes and said, sir, these things are already at your cap point, like 60 miles away. How did these things know where that location was at? So it makes you have to look at, is there a reason, maybe internal, something going on with, in this case, naval exercises? Now, you've got all this electronic data that they accumulated from radar, from the different ships, from the planes. You've got video recordings. You've got pilot descriptions. The Navy admitting these things, these videos are real. The radar crew stating that, hey, we track these things on radar. Also, you've got all this data. And the data, by the way, mysteriously, some of it was kind of, I would term as being ferreted away. Mysterious people showed up in military uniforms on board the ship, reportedly, and took the information, the data, on these data drives with them. So all we have at the end of the day is kind of like the pilot stories, the crew stories, and the videos. Also, the Navy did request a change in guidelines to get more reports in. Well, something I'd always wondered about was, is there a known explanation maybe inside? Well, an organization, a website called The Drive, goes back and they do a lot of articles on military defense, and so forth. They tracked down an individual who worked for Area 51. Now, this is one of the, I guess you could say, the old fart. It's the best way to term it, Chuck. This guy started back in the 1950s in radar. He also started working on the earlier missile systems, tracking systems for NASA. This guy had a ton of experience, and he also worked on a plane called the A-12, as far as the technologies with it. The A-12 was the predecessor for the SR-71 Blackbird. Now, this plane was to replace the U-2, the spy plane that flew like at 60,000 feet, of which one was shot down over Russia. Back, you remember the story about Gary Powers. Well, this plane was in development, and it would go, instead of like at 60,000 feet only, it would go like at high altitudes at Mach 3 and above, which you're looking at like 2,200 plus miles an hour. Super fast. But even though this plane is fast, they were wondering when they developed it, could it still be detected on radar that well? And the Russians, the Soviet Union, since they'd been developing radar technologies more advanced, could they track it and shoot some of these things down over the Soviet Union? Well, the Soviet Union had developed a new radar system also. And this is what they wanted to know, if it could track. Well, the CIA was involved. Again, the CIA was involved with the development of that plane. And they wanted to test this radar system out. So they worked on technologies, according to Barnes, this guy that was in the program. And he says, we had devices which could generate false targets into Soviet radar. And it would actually make the Soviets think that on their radar system that they were seeing these aircraft which were really non-existent. And this system is called Palladium. When I looked at this story, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, 1960s? They wouldn't. Well, you read it farther, and guess where they put these radar systems at? Cuba. Remember the Bay of Pigs, Chuck? Well, the Soviet Union put these radar systems down in Cuba. Well, the next thing you know, the U.S. says, well, let's put a ship down in the region, or let's put an aircraft up. And they had an aircraft that they put up that was one of these early electronics-laden aircraft. And what this aircraft was doing was developing false targets. It even developed these false targets good enough that one pilot in a Russian MiG was flying off of Cuba, and he thought that he actually had a lock on a true target. It was just a image generated electronically.
Wow.
Well, they could actually flip these things on. Here's the target. And if you can flip them on, you can certainly flip them off. I mean, you know, like turning it off, by the way. So they would turn the electronics off, and next thing you know, this thing disappears. When I'm reading this, I'm like, crap. Think about this. They're generating false targets off the coast of Cuba. I mean, around the time of Bay of Pigs. And some of these things could have almost led us into a war just in a way of checking out their radar systems. Well, what they were looking for is the Russian radar painting these targets, basically, and seeing, number one, could they detect the target? Or at least let's see how efficient their radar systems are.
Wow.
So this, yeah, exactly. Well, later on, they also developed a more advanced system. So this was in the 60s. You move forward. And, of course, with electronics, they found out that later on there was another system created that was called Genesis. This one just didn't generate like one image. It could generate like a fleet of objects. It could create the illusion of vessels on the surface of the water, objects below the water, and formations of objects in the sky. Well, the pilots on board these aircraft said, you know, hey, some of these radar systems picked up multiple objects, like these infrared systems picked up multiple objects.
Right.
Also, they made a comment that it seemed like something was jamming their radar. Could this possibly be something that we're developing be tested out there? Or who's to say that maybe a foreign country hasn't also come into that region and they're the ones putting out these false images, testing out our radar systems on our on board of our ships? Well, they tracked down this, this organization called The Drive tracked down another guy, another one of these old timers, but he also worked for the CIA. His name was Gene Poteet. He was involved with some of these other programs. And he said, well, they also did something else. They created, in this case, a system where, okay, yes, you had the electronic devices, but to judge how effective their radar was, they used something very simple, which was balloons. And they said they were launching balloons from, like, submarines. So they would launch these balloons up. They'd put the false image up. The radar systems that the Soviet Union would have would come up. They would lock onto the, or try to lock onto the target, look for the targets. Then here would be these balloons, and these balloons actually had devices in to gauge the efficiency of the radar. And they had different sized ones. And one of the things that I found was like a patent which showed a balloon that had like a cube inside of it. This cube was suspended, and they had different sizes of these because the bigger ones should be easier to detect, the smaller ones would be harder to detect. So based on the size, they could tell how effective these things were. Well, they were launching these things up, or at least that's what the patent showed. It would launch them and use them for detecting. Well, off the coast of North Carolina, the pilots that were flying in that Teddy Roosevelt carrier group reported when they were out on their mission, this object went between them and it had what appeared to be a cube suspended inside of a sphere. Now, I'm not saying this is exactly what it was, but it's similar to the description based in this patent. So again, could it be something that we're launching to check out the efficiency of these radar systems? And along with that, the Nimitz at the time had the best radar system we had. The Roosevelt, when it went out, also had the best radar system. This is also when they were working on what they called cooperative engagement capability, where it was like some of the first times that you had just not one, like a jet locking onto a target. You had the jets which can communicate with an E-2 Hawkeye, which is like a surveillance plane. They could communicate with the naval ships, and they could share all this information. Well, in the 2004 encounter, this was like stage one. Stage two was the Teddy Roosevelt, where they had a much more advanced E-2 Hawkeye system to be engaged in this whole thing. So, like I'm saying, I'm not saying this is what it is, but you do see some similarities in, you know, kind of like the stories. Well, they also went back and asked these individuals who were involved with these programs a little bit more about it. And they said, well, the other purpose of creating these technologies and, you know, seeing what the radar was like, see if they could judge how efficient it was, is they also wanted to evaluate to see if they could find ways to fool the radar, to always kind of like stay one step ahead of an adversary. So the point came up, well, wouldn't you think if they were testing stuff out, like with the Nimitz group, against the Nimitz group, that they would inform somebody in the Nimitz group about what they're doing? Just think about that. I mean, down in this incident down in Cuba, they're testing stuff against the Soviet Union radar. There could have been engagements down there. Who knows? Well, here, they're saying, wouldn't you let your own group know? And one of the individuals that they asked, again, going back to this Barnes, he said, well, when I was at Area 51, we didn't necessarily do that. He says, when we, let's say, had enemy planes, or I shouldn't really say enemy, but let's say a foreign country's planes, like you had a MiG-21 or you had other jets, they would put those jets up against our, let's say, National Guard pilots. And all they would tell them is, you're going up against a foreign MiG technology out at Nellis. That's it. They wouldn't necessarily tell them that, oh, by the way, this is an exercise being conducted by the CIA, the DIA, the Navy, the Air Force, anybody like that. You're just going to go up and basically play a war game with them, with a foreign technology, not let them know what it is. But you would think that somebody on the inside in the Pentagon would have to know someplace. I mean, Barnes, when he looked at these videos, they showed him the videos like Go Fast and Gimbals, the ones which are available for any of your listeners to watch out there. Well, when he saw those, he says, well, the pilots evidently saw the whole video. These are segments. Well, this is where the story separates. The pilots, one of the main pilots involved, David Fravor, he said, no, everything that's posted is exactly what he saw. Nothing is being cut out. But even though a number of things point towards the electronic devices, what it doesn't explain is in the case of the Nimitz case off the coast of California, Fravor saw an object hovering directly over the water. He went down to intercept, making a large circular pattern. The object mirrored his circular pattern coming up. But when he tried to cut across the circle to get to the object, it accelerated the speed. It was over the horizon in seconds, and balloons wouldn't be able to do that. They came out and said, yeah, but some of these balloons, guess what? They even had technologies to make them maneuver. But you can't make a balloon maneuver.
Well, I don't see how you could make it maneuver that fast, even if you could get it to maneuver at all.
No.
But there, it certainly seems within the realm of possibility that you could have some electronics in there that makes the image of the thing appear to make that maneuver and get the heck out of Dodge.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, they even went on to say that, guess what? Some of these special operation programs, they've been testing some of these planes out in Lake Washington State, in California, like Southern California. And when they develop some of these planes, like some of these Black Project planes, they're flying them to test them out to see if these things really are capable of performing the way they think they are.
Right.
And they say they do that before they take them to the military.
Yeah. And if they told people, oh yeah, we're running this up, then that would kind of defeat the whole purpose of the test, because they're really trying to find out if they can be detected.
You're right. And out in the Oregon area, Northern California, they have had UFO reports coming in of objects that pilots have seen, that some have appeared on radar, some hasn't appeared on radar, but nonetheless, they don't know what they are. And this may explain some of those sightings, that they're actually testing aircraft in that region, and you're just not telling anybody about what's going on.
Yeah.
And the way it sounds, that even includes like the FAA. They're just doing it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it's pretty weird, pretty weird. Well, Thomas, thank you for joining us once again on the New American Dream Radio Show. I really appreciate having you on every month. And, hey, looking forward to another year of it.
Right.
The next time we speak to each other, it's going to be 2020. So,
and you know something? It'll be 3 years.
Yeah.
It'll be 3 years.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've enjoyed it.
Well, I have too. I really have. All right. Well, hey, thanks again. And talk to you next year.
No problem. Thank you. We'll talk to you then.
Okay.
Yeah. Bye.
And to all of you out there in listener land, thank you. Thank you for joining me right here on the New American Dream Radio Show, streaming live every Thursday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And don't forget, it's listener-supported radio. They need you to head over there to freedomslips.com. Punch that donate button. All right. Thanks again. Good night.